Hello and welcome to episode 111 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Valentine, and Chris Weston. Well, it seems like an age since you and I spoke to each other in this online medium that we call Squadcast, which is how we record these shows. And that's because it's a month. And we've had live shows, we've had visits to the ITDF, we've had shows where I've cobbled it together because you were otherwise occupied, we've had a week off. A month has gone, summer's here, we're leaderless, rudderless. Watford had a horrific time at the FA Cup. How are you?
Yeah, it seems to have been, the time's flown by, hasn't it? And I can hardly remember the last time we did one of these. We've almost got out of the habit, which you must get back into very rapidly. Oh, I'm well, I'm okay. I'm suffering a bit with a bad back. I'm going to be more impatient and bad-tempered than usual tonight. But other than that, yes, I'm very good, thank you. Having a bit of a wrap-up of various contracts and projects this week before I go on to my new adventure next week. And also, we've been doing some... you've been on holiday, and there's been some work on the podcast pad project, and we had some feedback from my TDF, which I haven't shared with you yet. So that's, it's all good, really. How about you? Yes. You've been away, haven't
you? Yeah, I have been away. I've been in Italy for the last 10 days. Bit of time in Rome, looking at the ancient ruins, and then down to just outside Sorrento to admire the lemons and the enormous insects. Vesuvius looking out majestically behind ominous clouds and an awful lot of ice cream. So it's very good. And I also, on the flight back today, we're recording on Sunday, and I saw what I'm assuming father and two teenage children who'd obviously been to the Spurs Liverpool game in Madrid, and obviously because there was so much pressure on transport, they had a convoluted route back via Rome, and that just made me very grateful that I only had to get from Wembley after being utterly humiliated in a cup final. That's a long old journey they're doing.
Yeah, that is a bit of a drag, isn't it, to go to Spain just to play quite poorly. Never mind. Yeah, it's better to have experienced that kind of thing than not at all, I guess.
Exactly, and it will probably fit with the general Spurs psyche, hello Chris King, of being a bit miserable about football. So that's good. Anyway, onward. We have on the show a fascinating interview with Caroline Carruthers and Peter Jackson about a book they've written called Data Driven Business Transformation. And I went to see them a few weeks ago now to talk about the book and also talk more generally about the challenges of data in organizations. So I think we should probably just get on with the interview, don't you?
Let's go for it.
So the story starts with the first book, which is the Chief Data Officer's Playbook, which was published in November 2017. Mm-hmm. And Caroline and I were both speaking at a data conference in London, and Caroline had been presenting on the first 100 days of being a chief data officer, and I'd been presenting on delivering the data strategy in a cauldron of BAU. And over a cup of coffee, we decided it'd be an awful lot easier to do our jobs if there was a book on how to do it. We looked at each other and said, well, why don't we write the book? So that was really the start. And that was a book that was written from our experience as being CDOs, practicing CDOs, collective experience of our peers who were very generous in leaning in and helping us write the book. But it was very much for our community. And we felt that after the success of that, we wanted to write a wider book for business leaders.
Yeah.
For them to understand the power, the transformational power of data in their organisations.
So it really is, it's a data book for business people.
And what do you see as the barriers in business people at the moment to them being able to adopt more data-centric strategies in their organisations?
Well, I think there's a number of different things that we've found as we've been talking to it. One is, and it's not just with senior business people, but a lot of people have this fear of data, and we've created it because we've used maybe some complex terms, or we talk about things in an abstract fashion. And what we've done is created this idea that it's much more complex than it needs to be. Well, actually, if you're looking at spreadsheets, if you're searching on Google, if you're using social media, you are interacting with data. So we need to get back to basics and help people understand that this is just an asset and there are tools to help them use this and make their lives easier.
I think also that a lot of organisations over the past 20 years have been very focused on people, processes and technology, the classic triangle,
yeah.
and have forgotten data. And in fact, you know, designing business processes or building operating models without giving a mind to data is going to limit your transformational capability.
I think in some cases, we've gone far beyond not seeing the wood for the trees. There's so much of the wood, we don't value it anymore. And that's what happens with data. We've got such a large volume of it that we take it for granted.
That's interesting. The last barriers to the collection of data in organisations around the cost of storage mm-hmm. have pretty much disappeared now, yeah. haven't they?
Yes.
Indeed.
And so to an extent, I think it's possible to say that whilst it's not free, the storage of data, the collection of data is not incrementally more expensive, no matter how much of it you do now. And of course, with that comes a quite fundamental problem that if I don't see a cost associated to something, it's often difficult to associate a value to it.
In our first book, we talk about something called the hoarding principle. So the hoarding principle talks about how what we've done is overload our organisations with so much data. So we've become like those poor people live in homes where they're not homes anymore, they're just houses because they have to creep down corridors because they've crammed boxes full of junk, or they can't use their cooker because they're full of 1920s real magazines that they've been collecting and they can't sleep in their bed anymore. You know, effectively, that's what we've done for our organisations. We've overloaded them, we've created fat around the arteries full of data so we can't find the data that helps us do our work. Now, I know whenever I talk about deleting or moving data, all the data scientists out there start and have some kind of panic and tell me I'm wrong. I'm not talking about deleting it, but you move it into the metaphorical garage so that you can root through it when it's useful to you, but you free up the organisation so the organisation can work better.
I guess there's a data industry, and I think in things specifically in terms of the software vendors, mm-hmm. the cloud vendors, for whom actually there is interest in you having completely unmanageable levels of data because it locks you into their platforms, into their licensing agreements and all the rest of it. They see, you know, their ambition often is about just being able to have more and more of this stuff because it means it's harder and harder for customers
harder
to escape.
Pick.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. to pick. Do you think actually editing down it is a necessity? I've heard there's the data is the new oil analogy. There's a corollary to that, which is data is the new nuclear waste, mm-hmm. which is the more of it you collect, the higher your risk comes of something horrible happening.
Well, you had a lovely quote about that one, didn't you? The smelly fish.
Oh, yeah. Data doesn't age like wine. It ages like fish. And there's no point in keeping something that's going rotten. But I think that there is a good purpose for editing down. I think maintaining the data that is useful and efficient for your business is a wise thing to do. There's some very good technologies emerging that can seek out redundant data and give you metrics on when data is being used, what demand is around that data, and enables you to manage the whole bulk of the data better.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, you touched upon it earlier about the cost of data, and in a lot of times in the past, we've talked about the cost of data being the cost of the storage of the data. But really, that is not the cost of your data. The cost of your data is every single time somebody has to replicate a process because they can't find the data from where it's been done before, or every single time somebody makes a wrong decision because they had the wrong data in front of them when the right data existed somewhere else in the organisation. So what we're trying to do is just streamline the process. And it's you know, a bit like the Martini model, right place, right time.
You have focused this new book on general managers rather than sort of data professionals.
We have.
Do you think there's a fear amongst senior people in organisations at the moment that this might be, you know, with all the news there is around artificial intelligence and all the rest, is there a fear that they will be either found out or replaced, or?
It's a line I came out with the other day in a presentation I was doing, and it was around, I said, those organisations that get hold of their data and really leverage their data will survive. They might even succeed. Those that don't, good luck to them. Because the disruptors, the competitors, the innovators are building from a basis of data.
It's an asset. Why would you not use it? In the same way that why would you have people that work for you and not ask them to do things? Why would you have buildings that are assets and not use them? It's an asset that you already have access to. Why would you not use it?
So the first question on that would be, for me, because we don't have the skills. We don't have the people capability to be able to. So what are the sorts of things that you think organisations should be trying to be able to build to be able to start to answer that question?
Okay, so for me, data literacy should be a skill that we're actually pushing out through organisations, and it's something that I'm a massive advocate for, and I know Peter is as well. And for me, data literacy is nothing more than helping people learn how to understand, argue with, interpret, and tell stories with data. It's a really simple skill that we should be helping utilise at all different levels through the organisation. In the same way that we now put people on training courses for information security and basic skills like that, through to helping boards understand how they can really get the best from their data. Just because somebody is very good with finance or incredibly talented working with people doesn't mean they've got some of those basic data skills. So we need to put in place things to help them. And the book was one aspect of doing this. But there's other ways and other modes of learning. We just can't assume that because somebody's reached a certain level in an organisation that they, by osmosis, have picked up skills on data.
Yeah, the data literacy is a very, very wide thing. I agree with everything there. But I think it's also for people in an organisation to understand the value chain of data in their organisation. In other words, where data is coming in and how it's adding value to the organisation as it passes through. I think there's a lack of appreciation of that. People concentrate on business processes and business outcomes without understanding the value that's being driven by the data underneath it.
The other thing as well, and it's something that we've seen more and more, is that human beings are incredibly fascinating people, but what we do is naturally fill in the blanks. So if we read something, it's natural for us to extrapolate what we think it means. Well, because sometimes reports aren't written or dashboards are written in a particular way, we think we know what they're saying, but we've lost the art in some cases of actually challenging it. So an example I've used with a few companies recently is putting up a dashboard and asking what they think they see. And what they tell me they see isn't actually what the report tells them, because I don't use any timescale on the report, but they interpret it that must happen in a day or that must happen in a month. But then they're forgetting to ask the questions.
Let's just pick up again on that question about the ability to be able to interpret data and this thing about the skills that have been developed, particularly at senior level, around reading effectively balance sheets.
Yeah.
And, you know, price to earnings ratios and all of that kind of stuff. That's a very different skill set to being able to read data about things that aren't money, isn't it?
Massively different. And, you know, again, we can't assume that just because somebody's good at one, they're really good at the other. So it's making sure that we create an environment around data that it's accessible. I mean, I was talking to a senior person recently and they said, well, I don't think this is relevant to me. I don't deal with data. I just look at spreadsheets. But, you know, there's a whole wealth of other things that they should be thinking about within their organisations that's not just a number on the bottom of a balance sheet.
It's data is so much more than balance sheets. I mean, understanding patterns in data is really important, which you'll never necessarily see on a balance sheet. And geospatial nature of data and time series of data and behaviours reflected in data is so much more than the balance sheet. And I think that's why it's important that senior execs understand that there's value in having this sort of data presented to them alongside the balance sheet and then being able to interpret it.
The data, when people talk about data in organisations, I think there's also a predominant focus on structured, quantitative data. Obviously, we're now starting to see the ability for machines to get very different set of abilities to be able to mm-hmm. process in
much more speculative fashion
qualitative data, yeah. whether that's, you know, natural language processing or whether that's some of the stuff around being able to interpret images or whatever else. How does that fit within what's within the CDO role, and how does that fit within what senior execs should be thinking about?
I think the part that sits in the CDO role is harnessing that data and making that data then accessible to other parts of the business. I always see a CDO's role as being responsible and accountable for data and making it available to the business to make the decisions out of. So in the Dickwood pyramid, data, the next layer up, the information, as I call it, or we call it now, collected, curated, and contextualized data, is the CDO role, allowing the rest of the business to do the information and wisdom piece. So extrapolating that information, that data, out of an image or out of a voice file and presenting that in a way to the business that they can then use it is the CDO role.
And I think that just to labour the point a little bit more, it's all data within an organisation. So facial recognition, like you say, geospatial, audio, these are all different types of data and they're all things that could be useful within an organisation. The CDO role is, one of the wonderful things about it is that it cuts across the whole organisation. It's not siloed, because data isn't siloed within an organisation. If you're using it right, it does flow right through the whole organisation. So the CDO role can't be limited by the silos. And it does mean that you can then find things that may be more innovative within an organisation, because you're putting together disjointed parts that maybe necessarily haven't fit together before.
I'll give you an interesting example, sort of from the legal in general situation, or any perhaps pension provider. Traditional way to perhaps look at a pension set of data is on contributions and outflows. But then to start thinking about the geospatial distribution of those pension scheme holders might reveal new and interesting patterns. And so I think that is somewhere where a CDO brings, or a data scientist brings, richness to the data and understanding, actually, if we take that data and we plot it geospatially, or we combine it with another data set, for example, we might actually get new value out of that.
The other thing to kind of bring in mind there as well, though, is when we talk about data scientists and how they present back to the business, part of what we talk about in the book, though, is actually creating a common language, mm-hmm. and part of data literacy is making it accessible and understandable. So one example would be, let's pick on retail as an example. You know, having a report back from data scientists on bananas and understanding every single possible connotation of what you would ever want to know about bananas in a 40-page report that with some wonderfully colourful dashboards, maybe not the most useful things for a bunch of board members who were trying to make decisions based on what they've been given. Having a half page on, if you put bananas in green boxes, you will sell more bananas, which is a hypothesis that you can check, try, and do something with, can create an actionable. There's much more value in actually working together around the common language.
Mm-hmm. That brings us on to purpose. And within your book, you've got a model that describes the different facets. It's almost like an extended, something like the 7S model, mm-hmm. thinking about the different facets that you need to consider within an organisation to be able to become more of a data-centric organisation.
Yes.
And you talk about purpose within there. There's almost two things that you've described there that maybe are two sets of purposes that might underpin what an organisation wants to do with data. The one is to be able to create compelling stories, to be mm-hmm. able to use data to be able to give reason to things that you want to do.
Yeah.
And then the second is being able to use data to be able to test hypotheses, to be able to validate in iterative processes, to be able to see what works and what doesn't.
Yes.
And obviously for you know, the modern organisations who are totally data centric, the Googles of this world, the Ubers of this world, that's very much where they've put the focus. Is
completely totally, and they would very much be data centric organisations.
Can we just explore those two different things and maybe the different approaches that are needed to be able to deliver on them, and the I guess where organisations might be in their life cycle as to whether they need to do one, other, or both?
I think that they're both relevant, but if I pick on the one, the storytelling one, first. See, that one is about really engaging the hearts and minds of people in creating, using data as a way of driving a movement or driving a change or driving engagement within an organisation. So that really is about encapsulating how you get the people on board through the data. And we often use the phrase that, you know, data drives the digital agenda, it drives the machine learning. But actually people drive data. Without it, without understanding the purpose, without having them on board, without getting the whole army marching to the beat of the same drum, you are going to really, really struggle. But that's actually a very creative skill. It's using a lot of passion, empathy, energy, and bringing all that together to create that story. Whereas when you look at what we're talking about to test a hypothesis and prove or disprove, you're looking at the much more logical side. You're talking about the more scientific way of utilising data in a fashion that is, I guess, more locked down in a way.
The storytelling side, I think, also fits more into sort of the data science field and the explaining of predictive analytics, you know, why this might be happening, why this is happening, what the outcomes of these things may be. And I think the testing of the hypothesis and the iterative side fits very much into what you might call data ops or an agile approach to delivery, because you have that constant testing, fail, succeed, move on. And I think that is something that is used, that using data to validate an agile process and the route on that agile process is a very important use of data.
We do also have to be very, very careful about what we're talking about. And as I said earlier, you know, human beings are really good at filling in the blanks. Mm-hmm. So we're using all the relevant data to make the arguments and not just the bits that we like.
Yeah.
What was it, Mark Twain? Statistics and damn lies was the phrase he came out with.
Yeah, it's the challenge of confirmation bias, isn't it?
That absolutely.
The inclination. Interesting, I saw Rory Sutherland from Ogilvy speak yesterday. He's got a new book coming out next month. And his argument is actually quite counter to some of this stuff, which is to say, actually, we are heuristic and gut-based creatures, and there's that for a reason. It's because it's done us very well for evolution throughout. And that it's post-rationalisation that we're doing a lot of the time. But that can then lead to problems. So if you look at, say, the Brexit debate in the UK at the moment, what you've now got is two entrenched groups who are just basically picking the numbers on their side to try to logically argue with the other, and it gets nowhere, because actually every time you throw up a logical argument, you've created a logical counter-argument. So there's a balance there about being able to use it to paint vision as opposed to try to be able to justify against a counter position, which is, that can be quite problematic.
It is, but I think the interesting part about it is that if you address it with the want to learn, then it doesn't actually matter. So I agree that in a lot of cases we've used data in the past to justify our gut instinct. And in some cases there's nothing wrong with that, as long as we've learned from it. So if it's a case of our gut instinct said X, the data showed us X, then woohoo, our gut instinct was right, and how can we then maybe make it easier for people to learn from our gut instinct? If our gut instinct said X, but the data says Y, what was correct? And then feed that back into, do I need then to adjust my instinct, or do I need to spend more time working with the data? As long as we treat it as part of a learning virtuous circle, it's all useful.
Yeah. And again, I guess that can sometimes be one of those barriers to adoption in the first place. I worked for a few years for a marketing agency who focused on big experiential stuff, auto shows and the like. Mm. And there was this product about 10 years ago, product brought to market, which is like a pair of glasses, but it would track eye movement in 3D space. So you've got these sorts of tools for doing user interface design. This could be able to show what was looked at and what wasn't in a physical environment. And somebody floated this idea in front of the creatives to say, we could be able to get some very rich data here about what if your creative works and what doesn't. And I can leave it to you to guess what the reaction of the creatives was to that. They didn't want to know.
Yeah.
Because it would have broken what they saw as their magic. And to an extent, when you see you know, creative that is driven purely by numbers, you can understand why there would be that resistance as well.
You can, because I mean, if you look at, say, car design, for instance, you know, cars that were designed before computers got involved are many myriad, very intricate. They're more like pieces of art than cars. Now, when you have computers involved, so we're looking at streamlining, we're looking at the best way, cars are kind of morphing into a very similar type of design. So I can completely understand where they're talking about. But if I'll swing back around to purpose, is the purpose of a car to get you from A to B, or is it the purpose to be a work of art?
Yeah.
So by understanding what the full purpose of it is, you can then create a better product, output, service for the customer and the purpose that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah. So the last section in your model is around the tools.
Mm-hmm.
At what sort of level do you think senior people should be concerning themselves?
I think it's very important that the senior people understand that there are a new breed of data tools that are specific to data to lead to transformation and changing business processes. For example, swapping out the Excel spreadsheet for something that is more sustainable and operational in an organisation. A lot of senior people might not realise there is an alternative that is available to them. So I think it's really important that senior execs have their horizons broadened. That model, calling out data tooling in that way, actually raises that conversation, makes it an important part of the conversation.
Yeah, it's about not having to focus on the detail, or as Peter said, it's about the horizons being broadened, the art of the possible, and understanding the brave new world that there is and how useful data can be to them.
Yeah. And if you were to say, this is a very generalised thing, but you know, you need to ditch your spreadsheets and instead move to what sort of category of product, not necessarily name products, but what are the sorts of categories of products that you think people should be thinking about?
It would be data management products, how to combine and blend data together and analyse data in a product that's not a spreadsheet. So you can do bigger volumes, you can do it in the cloud, you can collaborate over that that data analysis and that data engineering.
There's data visualisation. There's tools out there now that basically put what we would have traditionally put as basic data science in the hands of anybody. So there's different ways of, and one of the things we talk about a lot about there being a problem hiring enough data people to service the type of need that organisations have now and in the future. Well, rather than just trying to churn out a bunch more data scientists quickly, if we actually put some of those tools in the hands of people who are really good in the finance or ops zones or the marketing zones, so they can do a lot of the base level stuff themselves, then that frees up the data scientists to do the really complex political stuff that organisations want them to do. So understanding that there's those kind of tools out there that can leverage the power of data in a more simple way, I think is incredibly useful.
It's also important for senior execs to realise and understand the potential of using the right tools for operational efficiency. You know, it's freeing up people. You know, stop throwing bodies at a problem, at a data problem, trying to fix a data problem by throwing bodies at it. Let's throw the right tools at it.
Yeah, don't build a house with screws and use a hammer.
Yeah.
Right, to finish up then, for regular listeners to the show, you'll have heard me talking about the priority cards that I've been working on in a number of fields. Now, there's a new set that are about to be released, and I thought it'd be an interesting test of how good these cards are, if nothing else. So we're just going to pick a few of these at random. We've got a few minutes left, and just see what you make of them, actually. I think, if nothing else, what ideas they spur. So this is the data priorities set. Who'd like to pick the first card?
Ladies first, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much. I love being the experiment first. Right, so first one. Use data science to gain greater insight into customer behaviour and improve customer engagement. Yes. Next. No.
I think that's an aspiration that lots of organisations want.
Mm.
I think they want to serve their customer better, get greater customer engagement. I think they want to understand full customer lifecycle value and churn and that kind of thing. And I think data science has a huge amount to offer in that space. The trick behind that, though, is tying up all the sources of data around customer. It's not only digital interface, no, it's experiential, it's in store, it's at the station, it's in letter, it's in magazine. If you can tie up all of those data sources, then you can get into this.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's making sure you feed the data science in the right way.
Yeah.
And I love the focus on customer, because I don't think we've got enough focus on customer when it comes to it.
But I think I always say around customer though, it's not only what we would think of as first knee-jerk reaction as customer. A lot of our customers as CDOs are internal customers.
Yep. And it's that
understanding
idea of
their need is really important, their interaction with the data.
Okay. The only other thing I would say is that's a brilliant purpose and I love it, but we have to think about the innovative side of things as well and sometimes let people play.
Are we spending too long on each one?
No, just go back. Next one.
Use data science to understand employee engagement.
Have you got a lot of data science ones?
There's a few in there, yeah.
I think that is really interesting. We're seeing a lot of employee engagement surveys. And I think that those surveys in themselves could be combined with other data from other data sources to give you a richness that then would be very applicable for data science. I think a lot of HR teams are very interested. It's an important thing to understand succession planning around employees and key employee engagement.
It's interesting. Of all the support functions, I think HR is the one that is most obsessed with the idea of analytics at the moment.
They are.
I'm not sure whether they're getting anywhere with it necessarily, but they're the one for whom it's highest on the agenda.
I think that we've seen a lot more interest from those kind of functions at the moment.
I think some of the vendors are pushing that as well. Some of the vendors around these employee engagement surveys are realising there's an upsell to their service if they supply some of the data science input.
And it really is a win-win, isn't it? If we actually spend a bit of time and attention looking at what makes work a bit more fun for people, then everybody benefits.
Brilliant. Okay. Two more? Yeah, go for one.
Right, see if I can do it. Oops. Establish a set of core principles for the ethical use of data. Yes, completely and totally. What we talk about a lot is, I mean, I'm a complete data geek. I love all things technology. And I love when we talk about artificial intelligence, machine learning, where that could take us and the benefits of the human race, which are just mind-bogglingly awesome. However, if we do not build ethical principles into the data, which is what we will be fueling all of those things with, we will be causing ourselves problems in the future. So I'm a massive advocate for actually us taking a little bit of time and attention now to make sure we build the foundations that we need to create the future that we want.
And that very much is something that has to happen at tops of organisations.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There has to be that culture of just because we can doesn't mean we should.
Yes.
I think that's really important. And that is a that's a buffer zone on top of legislation of things like GDPR.
Oh, God, yeah.
Okay, one last one.
Deliver organisation-wide education to raise understanding of the importance of data. This comes back to our data literacy. I think that if we're going to drive real value out of data, real transformational value out of data, this is key.
Yeah, everybody has to be on board. It isn't about having 10 data scientists sitting in an ivory tower creating some wonderful dashboards for you. You know, having every single person in your organisation all understanding the part they have to play in treating data as an asset and using it as a valuable tool to drive forward your organisation is so much more powerful.
So thank you to Caroline and to Peter again for making the time to have that conversation. It's fascinating stuff. There is a competition, which is very exciting.
It is very exciting. We're going to give something away.
We're going to give three things away. We've got three copies of their book, Data Driven Business Transformation, How to Disrupt, Innovate and Stay Ahead of the Competition, published by Wiley. We've got three copies of that to give away. We need a question.
What do people need to do to win these books, Matt?
Well, what they need to do is they need to tweet us. So if you're not on Twitter, you need to get onto Twitter. If you're not on Twitter, they're quite
some people.
Exactly. And then you need to tweet us at WB40podcast with the answer to this question to win one of these books, which I'm just looking at the back of it. Oh, no, hold on. Is it on the thing? I mean, it's so valuable they don't even put a price on it, which, you know, it's literally priceless.
How many pages, Matt?
Pages? There are some. It's a very high-quality public. I mean, there's about 270. 270 exactly, actually. There we go. So anyway, you need to tweet us at WB40podcast with the answer to this question. EF COD, the godfather of relational databases, what did the EF stand for? There'll be two prizes for the correct answers, and there'll be one prize for the person who can come up with the most amusing answer to that question. So there we go. Anyway, let's stop being like... Radio 1 in the 1970s, and let's switch back to conversations about managing technology. I thought it was a really interesting conversation. I think their book is really interesting, and I think the book is really interesting because it puts down in black and white all the mechanical things that you need to consider if you are serious about your organization becoming a data-centric organization. And I will tell you now, there's a lot of stuff you need to do.
Yeah, these are threads that if you pull on them, lead off in lots of different directions, aren't they? And it's very difficult to make anything happen in a fundamental way if you really want to change your business, if you don't follow a lot of these threads through to quite important data points and sources and I guess even the way that people interpret data or the way, you know, why they provide it. There's loads of really important things to do.
And I think the challenge with it, and this is something we talked about in the interview and I talked about with them as well off mic, is what they focus on primarily is the mechanical, the hard stuff. And then there's a whole bunch of the psychological, which is that actually humans don't make decisions on a rational basis a lot of the time. In fact, if ever. And interestingly, hopefully soon I'm going to be interviewing Rory Sutherland, who takes an almost polar opposite view to the kind of real acolytes of data. I don't think actually that Peter and Caroline are massive cultish, data is the answer to everything people at all. They're very pragmatic about it. There are a bunch of people, though, for whom data is everything, is the new oil, etc., etc., etc. And those people, Rory Sutherland is almost like the antidote to them, because what he says is people don't make decisions on a rational basis. We are heuristic-based creatures that make decisions on the basis of a bunch of things that evolution has given us that make perfect sense, but they're not rational. And therefore, you need to be able to use information amongst a number of other tools to be able to help people make decisions on the basis of how we as humans make decisions. There's obviously, there's the answer to this sits somewhere in between.
Yeah, well, that's true. I was talking to somebody this week about who was considering a CRM implementation. And you're right, as in an experienced person will take information from a CRM and they will use it to make decisions about how they're going to manage their sales force, for example, sales team, not trying to plug Salesforce as a project. And they will do that because they will know the context of that data. And depending on the time, you know, because salespeople, one of the reasons CRM projects fail, salespeople don't really like putting information to CRM. They make them do it. And if I'm selling widgets and I bump into somebody in the lift at a conference and happen to get talking to them and I see their name and their company and I know that they are a potential customer, but all I do is go, oh, hello, how are you? And I've got like 30 seconds conversation out of it, then I'm probably not going to put that in a CRM, because even though some people, some zealots might say, absolutely, it's got to go in the CRM because we've had a conversation with somebody from a target, as a salesperson, I'm probably not going to bother. Unless I'm under very severe pressure, it's coming towards the end of some sort of period. And then not only will I put it on CRM, I might put £500,000 worth of potential sales against it. You know what I mean? Even though the conversation was exactly the same, people react differently and they use that information in different ways. And then the people that have to interpret that data have to think about that as well, because you need experience to manage the data that comes out of the machine. It's not just something you can take at face value, and that's a learning, isn't it? That's something you have to realize if you're going to be a zealot about the fact that the data can drive decisions. You also have to understand that the data is subjective often. It is not always objective.
Absolutely. There's two things that spring to mind there. The first is our old friends, Goodhart, and the other one, whose name will come back to me in a minute, which are the two social science laws about how if you set numbers as being the target for some sort of change or some sort of activity, then the meaning of those numbers will will change. The semantic meaning of the number becomes different. So a sales lead, once recorded in the CRM and being tracked against sales lead targets for individuals, is no longer actually a sales lead. It's morphed into this thing that has a different meaning. You see this all the time, in particularly in policy matters within what government does, where things get latched onto as being useful measures of something, and then they kind of lose their value quite quickly because they become totemic in a way that nobody quite understands. So, you know, uniform police officers is a classic example, waiting lists, all of these things. They're meaningless because they become so loaded with meaning because of the fact they've been set as targets. The other thing, though, is actually a conversation I was briefly involved with on Twitter a couple of days ago, which was somebody saying about, oh, wouldn't it be great if we captured like all of the experiences of startups so that we never have to make the same mistakes again? And I said, you know, the only issue with that is that actually it's all contextual. So a decision that was made that killed startup A could be the thing that makes startup B a unicorn. And you will never know. And so this idea that everything is logical and rational, it permeates so deeply, and I think particularly anything to do with the computing community, because at essence, you know, computing is about turning the wild woolly world that surrounds us into something logical and rational. But we all know the reason why computer systems fail is because they can't deal with the woolly, even with the artificial intelligence stuff, or so-called artificial intelligence that we see at the moment, it doesn't deal very well with the complexity and chaos that is the human world around it.
That's right. And as you say, people who think that you can boil down these things to a set of decisions think you can model the world mathematically. You can create a model and then say, if we did this that wrong last time, we did it right next time. And you cannot create a model of the world, as you say. It is impossible.
So what do we learn from all of that? Well, actually, most organisations are pretty crap at some fundamentals of data. I still am amazed so few organisations are able to manage corporate data models at any sort of level of sensible and do it in any way that gives them value. But without that, if you don't understand what your data means, you don't understand what any of it means. Don't overinflate the hype. If you want to do stuff with data, though, you've got to be rigorous, and it's a bit dull. I think that's the other bit, isn't it? You need to have some boring, processy ugh that means that you know that your data is valued and valuable and traceable, and you can understand the provenance of it, and you know where it comes from, and all of that kind of stuff, which is an awful lot of heavy lifting to be able to get a new dashboard.
But it's all worthwhile, because then you can start to use machine learning, and that's what's really important.
Well, there is that. Anyway, don't forget, if you want to get a copy of the book, which is well worth a read, you need to tweet us at WB40. You need to answer the question, what does the EF in EF COD stand for? One prize for the funniest answer, two prizes for the rightest answers. Although I think there's a fairly binary state of rightness in the answers to that question. Drop us a line.
So what's up for you this week, Matt?
I have got lots of bits. There is a project around innovation that I'm doing for a consulting company that there might be some stuff happening on Monday or Wednesday. There's some stuff that I've got for a consulting firm that I might be doing. No, I am doing on Tuesday. There's some stuff for Podcast Power Projects is definitely also happening on Tuesday, and then the rest of the week we'll see where it goes. I think I'm supposed to be meeting up with Mr. Ian Cohen this week as well, which should be great fun. Although I'm buggered if I can remember where that is. There it is. It's on Thursday as well. So yeah, see what he's doing and trying to be able to turn taxis into self-automating monsters, or whatever it is that he does at Addison Lee. Now, you have got a big week ahead.
Yes, indeed, in that my career direction change is now upon me, and I'm going to go inside the belly of the IDC beast and get inculcated into that. So that's looking forward to that. Should be exciting. I've got a fairly busy week lined up, and lots of different meetings and things like that. So, yeah, I look forward to being able to talk about that next week.
Do you actually know what it is you're going to be doing in this new role?
All right, let's come back to that next week, and I'll tell you how that turns out.
That sounds good. Keep it flexible. Super. Well, we will be back again next week. I think we've got another interview in the can. I can't remember who it's with, but I'm sure it's going to be awesome. And I'm trying to be able to line up a few more this week as well, so that's cool. So I hope it all goes well for you with your new... your new career, your new creative diversion. There we go. We'll call it that.
I'm sure it will, Matt. I've got high hopes.
Excellent. And we will see you all, listen to you all, hear you all, whatever it is you do when you're on the receiving end of a podcast next week, usual time, usual place. And look forward to that. Don't forget, you can find us at WB40Podcast on Twitter. There you can send us your answers to the question, what was the EF and EF COD standing for? You can win a copy of the wonderful book. You can follow us on Instagram, bizarrely. And I'm sure that one day we'll work out Snapchat too. Leave us a review if you're doing it on a podcast platform, because we like reviews.